Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Hello. Oh, I love you. That's so kind. Thanks. Did everyone know those hymns?
Off by
heart. Amazing. Can I have a tissue? Because on the way in, I tripped over a cable and some coffee went on my hands. And I wonder if anyone has a cloth or a tissue or some fabric of some
cloth
description.
Or a tissue? It's on its way.
Given that it's a Christian festival, it's likely to be a compassionate crowd. Oh, it's so lovely. I've never been anywhere like this before.
Take a seat.
What about the tissue? Maybe it's coming from that direction. Ah, thanks. Cheers. Thanks, Paul.
Okay. Welcome to Greenbelt.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be at Greenbelt. Sorry I'm late, everyone.
When you tweeted that you were coming to Greenbelt, you said that you'd be talking about life, death, consciousness, dimensions, you know, the usual. So I think we better get stuck in.
We ought.
Your life in 2 minutes. Not everyone out there knows your Pilgrim's Progress. If you had to summarise it for people who perhaps just think, oh, he's that roguish comedian who's addicted to everything, how would you bring them up to date?
I would say they were already up to speed.
Seriously, you've been doing a lot of writing and podcasting recently about humility and being humble. And yet in your book, Recovery, you very honestly and openly write that I'm very grateful for my life where I get to show off for a living. And I think that's a really interesting thing. I wonder, isn't showing off perhaps fundamentally at odds with a humble and a spiritual life? And how do you reconcile those two aspects of your character?
All actions in the material world need be underwritten by some kind of spiritual connection. If you align yourself with principles that I consider to be universal, and that ain't that complex as far as I'm concerned, compassion, kindness, love, an understanding that unity it transcends separation, then I think you can do what you want. Like the principles that are within that would prevent you from, you know, like I'm showing off a little bit now, but it's quite moderated. And in my heart, I'm feeling only like, you know, I'm in front of a crowd, so part of me thinks, oh, I really want these people to like me, right? That is present. But primarily, I know that there is nothing that anyone can give me. And when I think of myself as a consumer and other people as a commodity, I can't be happy. When I think of myself as a servant, then I feel lit up. And I like that. So I think all my job is to make these people feel happy and content. And I know what it's like to be alive. I know what it's like to suffer. I know everyone has had experiences that it'll be difficult for me to understand. I don't think that I'm better than anybody else. I don't think I'm worse than anyone else. Anything worthwhile that I have to say is because someone has taken the time to teach it to me. Anything that I say is mental is probably the stuff I'm making up.
So as you came down, you heard this rabble singing hymns, which might have been an unusual entrance for you into an event of this nature. Possibly.
I must say, it felt like, this is how I should be living.
But as a festival, as an organisation, as Greenbelt, we wrestle and we struggle with religious language to describe who we are and what we're about, because The words we use can often become a barrier and an obstacle towards a good between us and a good conversation. And I just wondered, you know, for the purposes of this conversation with these people here, higher consciousness? Are you more comfortable with that? Or can I use the word God? How does language, religious language, work for you?
The function of language is to communicate, not to separate, although language can often be used to induce a sense of inferiority. I'm not talking only of high-minded, esoteric language, but even slang. Language can be used to insulate a community, to establish difference. For me, the point of language is community, connection, communion. In this environment, God. When I talk about, I wrestle with the same issues you do. We live in a sort of post-secular environment. It's easy to understand why some people would have aversion to some of the language around, for example, Christianity, because of the historic links with imperialism, colonialism, different forms of oppression. These are not like problems that I would lay at the feet of Christ, but rather the way that institutions often behave when they're empowered. These sort of seem to be relatively common human imperatives. If I was talking to a group of atheists, I would talk about the limitations of the egoic and individualized consciousness and say that every stage of post-rational materialistic thought we've assumed ourselves to be at the summit of the known, always surprised when new physical laws or sub-particular phenomena are revealed. Our capacity for knowledge is limited. Knowledge itself is limitless. At some point, faith will be required. At some point, we have to have an interface with the unknown. We have to open ourselves up to the possibility of the limitless. I choose, and choose seems like an odd word, to see that as the unknown is resourced from love, from unity, from connection. That's how it feels to me. So I've got no problem using the word God. When I pray, which I do every day, I'm not like translating the Lord's Prayer in my head to limitless field of all consciousness, hallowed be thy name. Our Father who art in heaven. I play it that way. I play it the straight lyrics.
In your book, Recovery, you wrote this. Take Christianity. Either it's so medieval and swathed in pageantry that it's droning and ridiculous, or they try and modernize it and make it all cheesy. Bad guitars, jumpers, knowing sympathetic looks. Here we are. Well, I don't speak for everyone, but I have sympathy with that assessment. What did you mean by that?
What I mean is, we're dealing with Christ. We're dealing with God in human form. We're dealing with transcending the material realm. That ain't something I would undertake in a jumper. Neither. And I think it should be liberated from the semiotics and appurtenances of the Middle Ages, because we live now. We live in this moment now, this moment now. So necessarily contemporaneous, necessarily inclusive, necessarily a physical platform for the sublime. So for me, it's difficult to build architecture and systems around that, particularly in an age where the individual is prized. It's difficult for people to see themselves as a congregation or a members of a parish these days. And often for me, my personal experience of authority has usually been negative. I think that's because I was always up to dodgy shit. But I like, for me, I only began to deal with a loving authority when I changed my perspective to spiritual principles, which I came at, as I'm sure you're aware, Paul, through recovery from addiction. That was, for me, how I began to articulate and understand my relationship with God.
Because you rate Jesus, don't you? You rate Jesus Christ.
You can't undermine our Lord. That's Jesus. Yeah, of course, Jesus. I think however you look at it, historically or metaphorically or in the sense of strict hermeneutics, nothing comes out of it that's not sort of phenomenal and amazing.
Well, we'll come back to that, perhaps, because it sounds...
Yeah, why not? People will like all that.
They will, won't they?
What are we going to do with these tangerines? We'll have a bit.
I think you should. I'm allergic, but you go ahead.
Why would you put food on a table that you're allergic to?
I didn't put it here. I had my minions.
Is up here? A knife? It's like Cluedo. Whole table smothered in murder weapons, Paul. You're living on the edge.
Hey,
I've never seen such trust for the Lord. cheeky.
Anyway, you strike me, Russell, as a real individual, and I don't want to sort of think about Life of Brian, and we're all individuals, but your individuality and your fierce independence, how does that square with your spiritual quest, with your pilgrimage in that sense? And you talk about the need for connection. I think you've already mentioned connection today, you know, with nature, with others. What about to communities and to movements? Do you see that as a spiritual thing to be connected?
Yes, it's necessary. One person realizing God on their own could be mistaken for a lunatic. Community is a movement. A community has possibility. I was thinking then of, I can't remember which philosopher it is, but someone will know here, that there's the, you know, the idea of transcendence, the idea of immanence, and the idea of expression. Our individuality isn't compromised when we think of ourselves as an expression, an individual expression of the whole. Sadly, one of the best metaphors that I ever heard involved a disco ball. Here it is. If you think of the source of light being one source, one glorious source, and that source striking the glitter ball, you know, like a disco ball, sorry for that analogy, but then the light that breaks out from it, the infinite varieties of light, all of us an expression of the limitless consciousness, all of us an expression of the limitless oneness, all of us with our own potential teleology to our own greatness, an expression of God. We understand it easily in nature. We understand what an acorn with nurture will become. With a human being, it's different. We all have cultural influences that inhibit, prohibit, sometimes degenerate us. But for me, individuality is not at odds with the love of God. Individuality is an expression of the love of God. Become as much you as it's possible to become.
At the outset of your recovery, you write very openly and honestly about the fact that one of the main barriers to you turning things around was that you had a distrust of people and of institutions. How are you with that now, and who and what do you trust today?
Well, like, I feel it's necessary to have an individual relationship with God imminently within. I have to have a connection to God within myself. I believe in a transcendent relationship in God in a couple of ways. One, beyond my egoic self, beyond the conditioned mind, beyond the me that bears the name Russell, beyond the me that I believe myself to be, beyond the me that's programmed and coded by my culture, my nation, my time, my gender, my race, my class, that there is a kind of a transcendent self waiting to be realized. All right. And what's the second part of what I'm saying?
I don't know.
What's the question again?
What I was talking about is, where are you now in terms of your trust of other people and of institutions? Has that changed?
Everyone is beautiful, really. That's where I'm at now. Everyone's beautiful, really. Just some people have forgotten. We must remind them. So when someone's dealing with you in a way that's not beautiful, and sometimes it's me, isn't it? Sometimes I'm sadly a victim of my own primal desires, my own conditioning, and I'm quite capable of being a bit of, I mean, what's the language parameters here? There's children. I'm capable of behaving in a way that's less than, not an expression of my higher nature. So then that's why we need community, isn't it? Because we're all mental, but not on the same day.
So at Greenbelt, and I don't want to speak up for all of you, I saw that. Actually, it's very helpful if you just take them all away.
Yeah, get rid of all of them.
Thank you.
I'm saving you.
Yeah, thank you.
From yourself.
I am afeard of the tangerine. At Greenbelt, we would see spirituality as fundamentally political and fundamentally knitted to a sense of wanting to get involved in social justice and activism. Famously, a few years ago, and I'd have massive sympathy with this. You were actually actively discouraging people from voting because, I don't know, you tell me, a sense that politics was broken and there was just a pointlessness to that. But for these people here, and perhaps for myself included, a lot of us, our sense of spirituality, our sense of vocation is such that we want to get involved in politics. What would you say to us when politics feels so disengaged and unrepresentative?
Could you draw your question out a bit, because there's more seeds in this tangerine? The first one, no seeds. The second one, multitudinous seeds. I wasn't anticipating it. I'm trying to deal with it now, but I like this question. I'm happy you've asked, but I'm going to answer it so much better when I've not got pith and pips all about my dental work. Why don't you do one of them hymns? All right, now I'm ready now.
Only if you sing the descant.
I'll do whatever you need from me. Right, here's what I think. Spirituality is politics. Where do you resource politics from? Where do you resource power from, if not spirituality? Even if it's the most atheistic, Marxist principles, where do you get the idea of fraternity? Where do you get the idea of oneness? Where do you get the idea that we all need to look after one another, that we are all the same in the eyes of some transcendent entity? Where have you heard these paradigms before? There is no politics without God. There is no point without God. That, for me, that's how I see it. Of course you have to be active. The reason that spirituality is kept discreet from politics is because of the certain knowledge that the materialistic world, governed by economics, can only be overwhelmed when people have an individual connection with spirituality that they value more than their materialistic connections. When people achieve that, we will rise up. There is no separation. Thank God I got rid of those pips.
Yeah, they were really holding you back. And so where are you at now then with politics? I mean, not that we've brought you here to talk about it, but what do you think, you know? What do we need to do? How can we reimagine it and re-energise the political life of this country, for instance?
I feel power should be as close to the people affected by it as possible. I feel that we have to look beyond centralized, institutionalized structures and truly democratize power. For us to feel empowered in this space now, we don't need to elicit the abstract support of some secondary entity. We have our own direct connection with that. We don't need to set up some institution elsewhere to tell us where we're going, to tax some of us in a certain way and others in another way. For me, this is a time where power should be as close to people as possible. That people should be able to run their own communities, their own schools, their own hospitals, their own judicial systems. This is what I believe in. This is what I believed in then. I was less articulate when I said, I didn't say don't vote full stop. I said, you're not presented with any real choice. The institutions that determine where power lies operate above the level of government. That's what I said. And then the don't vote bit, that was a catchy little dig at the end. And people focused on that. And for me, whenever you get a lot of negative attention from people that own transnational media conglomerates, there's a possibility that what you're saying might affect their interests.
And is that perhaps a really good example of the way that the life that you're living and what you're trying to do with your life, as far as I can tell, and what do I know, isn't easily translatable into sound bites. And do you think that people sort of understand or get you less now than they perhaps thought they once did, when they thought you were just easily pigeonholable?
I don't know, and I don't mind, and it's none of my business. I'm here to do what I'm doing, and I hope that it translates, and I'm just gonna do what I'm doing, and everyone else will do what they're doing. I no longer feel that I'm obligated to be sort of a lightning rod or to be feted or adored. In fact, I have to work really, really hard on my tendency towards egocentrism. If I think in simplistic terms, even though I'm capable of communicating in convoluted ones, that I am just here to be of service and to be loving and to try to realise the principles I believe in, then I don't have to worry about results. I'm not in the results business. I do the work, and then the results is none of my business.
Thank you. And What about Jesus?
So it's good I'm not a football manager. Because if you were, I'm not in the results business. I'd say, well, you're fired, because we actually are in the results business. Because it's 3 points for a win, one for a draw. F all for pithy little epithets. I heard someone shout West Ham over there, and I presume you're watching the score against Watford. And you're 2-1. Well, let's not get bogged down in that. We're talking about... It's not a riot over a football score at a Christian festival.
Yeah, let's talk about Jesus instead.
All right.
You said earlier on, you know, you use the language of, you know, Jesus is Lord, Jesus Christ. Who is that figure for you? You know, we use language like suffering servant, teacher, healer, son of God, saviour, Messiah. Who is he? All of those things? None? Or who's this figure to you, Russell, in your life?
Perhaps none of us are entitled to offer an ultimate definition, and perhaps it's the malleable nature of the Christian templates and archetypes that have allowed it to be so globally successful millennia after its inception and initial profligation. For me, the idea of Christ is to be found in less vivid forms in any sainthood, the idea that we can be beautiful, or for me, the idea that I can be reborn moment to moment unto myself, that I can be free of the aspects of myself, my own tyranny, my own prejudice, my own tendency to be selfish and greedy, that there is an example of in flesh these things being overcome, that the kingdom of heaven is within. For me, how I use it, and I guess there are as many examples, interpretive examples of Christ as there are Christians or perhaps even humans, but for me, it is the possibility that I can realize God, that he has no hands but ours. And if I am of service, if I am living beautifully, then I'm doing my bit. I'd love to get into the whole miracles game. That would be amazing. But I am satisfied with living compassionately and lovingly, and to know that it is possible while being a man, while experiencing desire, while experiencing jealousy and greed and self-centeredness and the ego, it's still possible to be beautiful. That is the truest love, that's the truest expression of me, and that all other things are a distraction, an illusion, are temporary, and that it's possible. So I suppose in Christ, I see continual possibility for a real and vivid living present connection with God.
That's right. And as part of your 12-step discipline, you acknowledge the importance of confession. Is that just because it makes you feel better, or is there something bigger than that? Do you feel a sense of genuine forgiveness, and who do you think it was, or where did that forgiveness come from, do you think?
Feeling better shouldn't be underestimated, because that's where, you know, my life comes from here, is resourced from there. For me, the way that confession works in a 12-step program, I'm sure some of you know, I don't imagine there's a crowd of this size without a fair number of alcoholics and drug addicts, you know, scattered about the place, clinging on for dear life. In 12 steps, the principles of confession are practiced like in partnership with something called like a sponsor, where you inventory your past resentments, the things you've done that you regret, the things that have happened to you that are regrettable. You list them and in a systematic way analyze them. And I won't go into details of that, but it's pretty amazing. And then you share it with someone else. What that helped me to do was to let go of the feelings of shame, worthlessness, total lack of trust that had previously motored my nature. My emotional nature was governed by the idea that I had no value, that I was not beautiful, that I was not capable of being forgiven. Once I was able to share everything that I'd ever done, and it's a pretty exhaustive process, then I felt free, I felt accepted. And from that point, I recognized that I needed to forgive anyone that I believed had transgressed against me in order to be forgiven myself. And for me, though, mate, while we're in this territory, the important thing is about fear and redemption. I live with a lot of fear, and I have fear still. But I see that verse from Isaiah once when I was in Brixton prison visiting. I'm doing a poem, right? And I was scared because I was scared of, you know, I guess I wanted people to like me. And then I see that verse from Isaiah, "Fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by your name. You are mine." And I liked hearing "fear not" because I didn't want fear. "Fear not, because I have redeemed you." And I thought of redemption in terms of forgiveness. And I thought of redemption in terms of coming home. But I didn't think of redemption in terms of the way you redeem a voucher to reclaim your coat at the end of a night at a disco. "Fear not, for I have redeemed you. I've called you by your name." Not just, "Woo, hello, I've called you by your name. You are mine." I thought, oh my God, the price of fear, the price of freedom from fear is that I don't belong to myself anymore. I belong to God. There's nothing to be afraid of because there is no me. There is nothing to receive the fear. Freedom. Freedom from the constraints of the ego. Freedom from the need to be adored by other people. Freedom for the need to dominate or depend or possess. Being redeemed. Redeemed as in forgiven, but redeemed as in belonging to a higher self. I like that idea. That gives me liberation.
I'm thinking about "fear not." I've got too many children. There are four of them. And I fear for their...
Too many?
Too many. For the planet.
there was an upper limit and you exceeded it.
I did. I was very careless. Like you and the Pips. I picked the wrong orange.
And there's some good seed jokes to be had there. But
yes.
I'm not going to do them because I know the audience.
Thank you for your restraint.
That's a first.
But I fear somewhat for their future. I see things, well, in the way that I read your life, I see that you have rejected a certain model, a materialistic model of living, which feels like it's overburdened and cracking under its own weight. It's at an end, and you're trying to model something that might be the future. But it's going to take an awful lot more of us to do that for us to have a future together. And so I worry. What do you feel hopeful for the future?
Yes. Total hope. More than hope. Faith is what I feel about the future. Look, I recognise that the consumer commodification paradigm is not a pleasant place to live. The limited frequencies of fear, desire, hatred that are broadcast on our media, the way that we're regarded as workers and dumb consumers of products, it's not a particularly optimistic worldview to introduce new life into, but we're their parents, aren't we? And, you know, look, don't get me wrong, I'm scared the whole time. And, by the way, I'm far from over my own materialism, my own self-obsession. It continues to be a moment-to-moment inner dialogue, shall we say. Struggle would be a perhaps more accurate word. But, look, this is my feeling, mate. If there is some limitless force, some limitless love, some all-potent force of consciousness operating behind all matter, transcending the rules of physics as we know them, keeping the heavens spinning in their spheres, giving his only son, bringing love into all our hearts, all the beauty that you've ever seen, the beauty of this day, the beauty of this moment, the beauty of the trees around us, then this thing is not fragile. This is a great power. And this great power is accessible to all of us. Merely a choice. Needn't be fragile and apologetic about our spiritual beliefs. And when I was writing that thing about clanging and medieval or a bit too kumbaya, my lordy, what I'm talking about is we need to access the force. We need to access the force of God. And for me, I like that shit.
But do you think that divine power will sustain and give us our future? Or like you said earlier, do we need to really be actively wrestling? We are the hands. I mean, what is our role in securing that future?
I think all of our roles are different. I think we have one collective ideal, and I think we're all pretty clear on what those are. Kindness, compassion, acceptance, tolerance, forgiveness, love. Simple ideas such as that. For me, it's important that my own spirituality is about my behaviour, not about other people's, not some inflection or refraction that I go, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing that. For me, it's like this. I live in accordance with my love of God, with my spirituality. And when I recognise myself getting all pedagogical and didactic and telling other people what to do, then I recognise there's a problem with me, and that's where the problem needs to be resolved. Now, when it comes to my two little daughters, I just want to give them the truth as the best as I understand it. But believe me, they're like only one and two and a half, and they're hitting me with a lot more truth than I'm hitting them with.
You describe your addiction as a calling, as a blessing. Now, when I read that, I was strangely moved. I was really moved. Something in that struck a chord. I felt like I loved that thought. What did you mean by it?
If you're an addict, this is personal to me, but it's also embedded in the 12-step system, which is a sort of, I suppose, like fused from the psychiatry of Carl Jung and first century Christian principles such as found in like William James or whatever. The idea that we are looking for something, like you've heard of the maxim, every man that knocked on a brothel door was looking for God. The idea that we get involved in drugs and alcoholism, for me, I remember it. I know the feeling of yearning, longing, craving. This is a pulling towards. As the heart thirsts after water, the heart as in deer, you know, old English. As the heart thirsts after deer, as the heart thirsts after water, so I thirst after thee. That there is a real hunger. There's some people can't live without God. Some people can't live without God. And then people are quite likely to end up crackheads, you know, because you got to have something, man. Like, because, like, if you grow up in a world that says, oh, this is life, your job is you've been born in Grays, Essex, and you'll be going to school, and you'll be encouraged to sit quite still. We're going to expect you to memorize these facts, and this is what reality is, and this is how reality operates. If you've got some surging force within you, some crackling symphony in your mind saying, no, there is more, there is more. I can see angels in the trees. I can feel things. There's some other things happening here. Then you've got to find another way to achieve that connection. The reason people develop, I think in my humble opinion, some mental health issues, and I would go as far as to say all addiction issues, is because they are longing for a connection with God. And the 12-step program is pretty explicit about that. Steps 12 is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, meaning that the problem in the first place was a lack of spiritual awakening. And I would take this further, that we are all in one form or another addicts. We are all suffering because of our attachment. We're all suffering because of our belief in material things or abstract things. And all of us have the potential of liberation through spiritual awakening. And I don't mean that just for myself or for you. I mean it for everybody. And my job is to get in line with that idea and to talk to people like we're on the same path together and we're traveling towards awakening together. We're all going to the same place. We're all heading in the same direction. I don't know their destiny. All I need to do is line myself up correctly with mine, and my job is done. My job is done. I'll be used. But if I'm all over the gaff trying to sort my ego out, trying to fulfill my, frankly, rather rapacious carnal desires, then very little's going to get done of value.
In the Bible, it talks about this idea of a great cloud of witnesses who might have gone before, who are, in a sense, there cheering us on in other realms. And your book, Mentors, you talk about people who have come into your life and profoundly shaped and helped you. Are they like your community, even when they're not present individually in your life? I love the way you describe them. They're all very different, but they clearly have played a significant role at just the right time. Are they your community, those mentors?
In a way they are, Paul, but in another way, what mentorship means to me is a sort of willingness to not trust my own mind always. You know, sometimes I think some pretty crazy stuff. so I'm willing to run it by someone else. Particularly, now I see suffering as a communication, pain as communication. If I don't feel on the beam, if I don't feel connected, if I don't feel that I am worthy of love and worthy of loving, then that means I've gone out of alignment. If I'm out of alignment, I don't tolerate it. It means I have to talk to someone. I'm feeling these things. I'm thinking of doing this. I turn to someone else immediately. For me, I go to people further down the path. People that have, in my case, not drank or taken drugs for longer than me. People whose spirituality I respect. People who I respect in various areas of my life. And they are able to remind me that the cause for all suffering is separation from God. The cause for all suffering is the belief that I am an individual separate from the world and that my job is to try to fulfill my petty, trivial desires. You know, as I love the quote, even though it's been somewhat misused, we've been taught that freedom is freedom to pursue our petty, trivial desires, when true freedom is freedom from our petty, trivial desires. When I'm free from that, I feel good, man. And like, and when I start believing again that my job is to get like another pair of shoes or some accolades or often things I wouldn't mention in front of you guys, then I've become misguided again and my job is to get myself back in alignment. I've learned to recognize my own dissatisfaction, my own suffering as signals that I need to get back in alignment, that I'm not here to suffer and be in pain. I'm here to be of service, and the suffering and pain is an indication that I've once again fallen into illusion.
So Greenbelt describes itself as a festival of artistry, activism, and belief. We've done a little bit on belief and activism.
We have. We went really cracked on quite a religious... I mean, I think the Archbishop of Canterbury will go, bloody hell, mate, slow down.
Yeah.
You're coming across as a bit too religious.
He was here this morning, actually. I can hear
Where's
him saying
it. Where's he
gone? It. Yeah. What about arts? You write about how there are some things which are just too deep to be expressed through philosophy or words or physics. What about the arts? Because we really value and cherish the arts. What's your understanding? What's your sense of what the arts are in our life for being human?
Only things that there are words for are being said. And sometimes in great art, or visual art or audible art, I feel like the delicate interruption from another realm, like a poem so beautiful, a painting so perfect that it feels like it's referring to something beyond the senses, somehow a temporary collision achieved through brush strokes and through tone can elicit the feeling that there is something beyond. There is something beyond. Sometimes a song, the great art can do this. Great art can reach out, reach beyond. It's very easy to feel that there is only the world of the senses, that there is only my individual needs, that all people then become either a potential vessel for dependency or domination, that I need to use people. But like, great art can, for me, be illustrative that the most profound principles are found beyond self-centeredness, indeed beyond self, that there is a kind of oneness, a glorious oneness beyond my sort of ongoing difficult relationship with the ego. So when I think of there's spectacular art, we could get into like the Aristotle of it all. There's some art that's just stimulating because it's amazing and it's sexy and there are explosions. But then there is art that can transpose divinity, can introduce us to the sublime. I see some film, Kaguya, Princess Kaguya, Japanese animation film some of you will have seen, and such beauty in it, such beauty in it. We read things sometimes that touches you. The very fact that there is a mythic imagination, the very fact that we do respond to archetypes suggests to me a submerged universal language that we can access perhaps through prayer and meditation, and some people can access through creating, and most of us can access through receiving art, a suggestion of the sublime, a reminder of what we really are. Tell me when we get near the end, Paul, and I'll be all silly and lighten it up. In case it's too serious.
Yeah.
Them crash barriers are a bit intense, aren't they, mate? Like, what's been going on in here?
You need to stick around and find out or something.
Oh, Christ.
So, you mentioned your daughters, your family, and in your writing, you write very openly about about them and your partner. How do you juggle, or how do you protect and manage all that with, you know, with you in the spotlight and you writing about them? Is that a delicate thing that worries you, or is it?
No, because actually, as soon as I had children, it helped me to realise that not only was what I did for a living meaningless, I myself was meaningless, only really a vessel for their service. Like, being a father, very good for the narcissism, it smashed it like a fly on day one. There's only so many times you can handle other people's feces and realise your proper place in the world.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
I like it. I don't feel like it. No, it's not. Like, for me, I'm lucky. I've got a home, I've got a family. This is what's real for me. This is where I feel things very vividly. They fill me up. They fill me up. So the rest of my life, I can remember, all right, try and be useful, try and be of service, you know, but I recognise it is my job to provide and to protect, and those quite traditional values. But, you know, like, no, it's not a distraction for me. Before was a distraction, when I was just some roaming nomad trundling after limitless desire, misinterpreting impulses, lost and baffled, looking in hedonism for some kind of connection, but that's more like distraction, craning into the decadence that our culture teaches us will be of value, looking for something truthful there. There's nothing there. I'm lucky to have been really, really famous. I'm lucky to have been to all them shindigs and been around great wealth and all of that, because I've seen it. I've seen, like, there's nothing there of any real value. Not that I would like to be dirt poor again. I prefer not being dirt poor and wearing rags as a choice. But like, but I know where the true value is to be found.
Thank you. And before we perhaps do light it up, and would you be willing to take some questions?
Yeah, all right. Let's take questions.
Yeah.
You're really lovely, by the way. I've been glancing over at you during this chat. I've been looking at your eyes. You're warm and you're kind and you're lovely. There's no doubt about it. You're really nice.
Thank you.
You're sweet and you're passionate and you're compassionate. So, I really like it here. When I arrived there and everyone was singing hymns for, this is my kind of bloody shindig. What will I do? Just stand here?
Yeah, so what we'll do, though, we have a microphone here, so if you have a question...
In front of this grassy moat.
Do not leap. Please, can we have questions and not chapters
statements.
Or theories and statements?
Yeah.
Questions, short questions. And I've got one at the end about death, so don't do that.
Oh, bloody hell, mate.
Yeah, come on. Okay, yes.
Yeah, for Christ's sake.
Hi, Russell. Glad you could make it. Wonderful.
All right.
All right. Favourite book, mate, can't be one of yours, just saying.
What's that then?
Your favourite book.
Oh, what is my favourite book?
What one that really changed your life for you?
I like Moby Dick quite a lot, you know. That's some heavy shit in there. Like, he's dealing with some pretty powerful themes. I really, 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 really like Moby Dick. If you want something on a more spiritual trip, you might want to check out some... I do like your man C.S. Lewis on Mere Christianity.
Nice.
I do like Emmett Fox, like his stuff on the Beatitudes and that. So, what am I reading right now? What am I reading? Oh, I'm reading a lot about George and London because I'm writing something about Dick Turpin. Oh, the way they carried on was a sin.
Okay.
How do you feel about Deepak Chopra?
I like Deepak Chopra. I think he's a beautiful man. I think he's, I think he's bringing the light.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
Thanks. Can't reach. What are we going to do about that microphone? It's looming above you.
We've come down from Blackpool and we've experienced 87 seismic events this week due to fracking.
Oh.
And we're worried about the planet. My granddaughter wants to give you a bracelet. And we wonder, what would you do? What is your approach to the environmental movement? We do it as nanas. We try and engage all sorts of members of the public to join us in protest. And we've done 1,000 days. I wanted to know where you stand on the environment and how we can fix it.
Well, obviously, you are much more versed on these matters than I am, so I would take your advice. It seems something that you're devoted to and dedicated to, and I've got no reason not to trust you. More broadly, it seems evident to me that if we have an attitude to the world that it is a commodity there for our usage, that the world is there as a resource to be plundered, that ultimately there will be a price for that, that whatever your politics are, left or right. Oh, I get a bracelet out of this, do I? Say no to fracking. Yeah, I mean, I like a for me, an attitude of love and nurture and respect to the world is paramount. And usually, though, when you express an opinion, as I've said before, that affects the interests of the powerful, they'll give you reasons why, you know, they should be allowed to carry on making money. And that's the opposition you'll face. It's always the same. Change is possible. It's just not possible to change and continue to make vast profits plundering the world as a resource. That's what really has to change. So I'm on your side.
Thank
you. And thanks for the bracelet.
Yes, please.
Hello, I have no bracelet to give you.
I'm what?
I've got two questions. The first one is, in other places, you've described the birth of your daughter in very graphic detail. And beautifully so.
Yeah, because graphic suggests, although it might have been quite graphic, I mean, childbirth, anyone that's been through it, so I'm talking to women in this
cesareans.
It's pretty hardcore stuff, huh?
So, how does your wife feel about
my
it?
My wife did make me take, good question. There were some bits she made me take out because I wanted to really recreate that experience. She said, you're not putting that bit in. That's private. And there were some metaphors that she was not happy with, but I gave her editorial control and she exercised it.
Very wise. The second question that I wanted to ask you is when I struggle with stuff, I phone up my friend Sarah, who's very wise, but you've got Eckhart Tolle's number. What sort of things do you ask him?
Well, Eckhart Tolle made the mistake of giving me his phone number. Well, he didn't give it to me, actually. Someone else gave me Eckhart Tolle's phone number, and I treated it like it was my own personal Samaritan's hotline. Started offering an Eckhart Tolle quite big problems, but by the end, it was like, the milk's gone off. I like Eckhart Tolle, because he's a transcendent being. He's not struggling with the stuff I'm struggling with. You know, for him, like it's space and time and the temporary patterns that govern our animalistic experiences here on Earth are merely conceptual. He lives in the limitlessness where all our laws of physics would fall away like phrenology and old superstitions. There in the limitless, what place is there for silly, silly rules? Anyhow, I had his number and I'd like to ring it. Well, this is Eckhart Tolle. He speaks so peacefully because he is so transcended that he can barely be bothered to talk at all. Like that when you're a kid and you go, for too long. That's how Eckhart Tolle sounds. He amazing. And what I would ask him is things like, I'd say I was in a relationship that I was having a hard time with. I'm in this relationship. Obviously, what I'd done, as people do in the post, like resourcing from romanticism and true chivalric tradition, the idea that you can find divinity through romantic love, I would deify in my partner and expecting them to serve as my connection to the sublime, a mistake many heterosexual men make in thinking that females can somehow embody their own connection to fluidity, femininity, and divinity. I made that mistake because I was at that point not awakened to that particular malfunction. But Eckhart Tolle, he talked me through it as patiently as he could. Well, Russell, perhaps you and this woman will be together for the rest of your life, and then you will both die. He was a purveyor of home truths, old Eckhart. So he would just basically tell me, be present in the moment, love and kindness. The rules are pretty much the same always, aren't they?
Thank you. We've got
love to your friend Sarah.
We've got time for perhaps a couple more.
Okay. Hey.
Well, these lovely kids.
Sorry, I didn't see this microphone over here yet. We ought to go over there. Next question. Make it a quick one.
That kid had a biscuit. Almost clay. I nearly ate that. Thanks.
It's about love of the universe.
Oh, darling, tell me again.
It's about love of the universe.
This is about love of the universe. Yeah. Oh, my God, what a wonderful concept. I'm really grateful. What's your name?
Tiva.
All right, Tiva, thank you for this. I shall cherish this. Clay heart with my initials on it, which symbolises love of the universe. That means love without discrimination, love for all things. The love I feel for my daughter, I must feel for all people's sons and daughters. Try to embody love. Try to let go of my selfishness, and then I can be free. I will remember this when I look at this beautiful heart you have given me. Tiva, thank you.
Thank you.
So listen, I think we are sadly...
Sadly what?
At the end of our time.
Why? There's no such thing as time. We've discussed that. It's one of the main themes of the event, Paul.
I haven't been paying attention. I've been starstruck.
You've been up there scoffing tangerines. I don't need to go nowhere yet.
Well, yes.
Quite hungry, if I may say. Hunger has happened. If anyone knows where I can get vegan food somewhere, please.
Yes.
Over there. That animated you, vegan fools, yeah? Hello. Ah. Oh. I love you, mate. You're lovely. All right.
So ooh, listen.
What's this? A yes bar? I'll take it. Sumptuous cranberry and dark choc. All right. Why not?
Okay, seriously, folks.
Thanks. All right, I like it here. It's like a reverse feeding at a 5,000. Come. There's a large crowd has gathered. Let me take all their stuff. Oh, no, I am the Antichrist. They were right at school.
Okay, we are at the end of our time. I hope that you have enjoyed our audience with Russell Brand.
Oh, thanks, I love you. Thank you.
Thank you, Greenbelt. That's all we've got time for. This has been Russell Brand.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.